Welcome to the More Than Fitness Podcast.
We're absolutely good to go on anything that you want to talk about, Yusuf. We could talk about absolutely anything. I have a few subjects here that I think I wanted to touch on, but anything goes. Like we can chat about literally anything.
Sweet. Let's do it.
And starting off, I want to just say first thanks for coming on. I think I've honestly followed Propane Fitness for a very long time, and I didn't even like realize it honestly until recently. And then I found you because I got involved in like startup Twitter or whatever you want to call it. Like there's this weird little echo chamber of Twitter people. It's like like writing and entrepreneurship and startups and just like clear thinking. And it's been wonderful. Actually, the people in there are great. And there's a few other fitness people that also delve in that realm as well. And so I found your tweets, which are amazing. And so I love just your wittiness. I think you're super smart. But I think the most important thing that I admire from anybody who is a content creator, a coach, or whatever, is just like, you look like you're having fun. And that I want to condemn you on. So yeah, thanks for coming on. And thanks for all you do, dude.
That's very kind of you, man. Thank you. And I think, yeah, if you're having fun, that's going to be reflected elsewhere. And I think it's one of the big mistakes I think people make with social media and online presence is they're trying to be some kind of highlight reel of somebody that they aren't. And it just comes across as either inauthentic or just a bit weird.
Yeah. And I'm going to go ahead and jump on that because I've talked about this with other people and I go back and forth with it in my own head because I 100% understand how like you or I could tell somebody like whatever, just to be authentic, be your true self, whatever other cliche you want to throw out there. But then for the person who's just like getting started or coming up, it's so much easier, especially whenever you don't know what the fuck you want to talk about at all and you don't know what you're good at or whatever, you're still figuring out those skills to follow somebody who is making the memes or making the infographics or the kind of the path most traveled. You're like, oh, this guy had a lot of success with this, so I'm just going to mimic them, you know?
That's all of fitness Instagram. Yeah. Is just copy paste personal trainers doing what they see other PTs doing. And I guarantee if there was some kind of analytics where you could see the financials of these people, it would be so shocking because we've worked with a lot of personal trainers in helping them grow their businesses. And the ones who you think are doing really well from how they're portraying themselves on Instagram are often really struggling to get clients. And it's just because I think optimizing for traffic and optimizing for conversions are very different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that probably goes with multiple industries, honestly. But fitness, yeah, in general. Maybe we can touch on that in a sec. I do real quick want to just give a brief formal introduction and appease the podcasting gods. But the way that I ask this usually is just like whenever you meet a new person, whenever you meet a random stranger, how do you introduce yourself in what you do? If they're like, hey, Yusuf, what do you do? What do you say?
Oh man, see that depends on the person who's asking and whether I'm gonna bore them with because sure. I'd say I wear a few hats, and so whichever the one that I think they'd be most interested in, not just gonna glaze over with.
Yeah.
But to give you a kind of overview, Johnny and myself, so my business partner and me, set up Propane Fitness about 2009, so about 11 years ago. And it was really just a sounding board. It was just a way to get our thoughts down on paper, just a kind of standard template WordPress blog. And what you said there is quite common. We do hear a lot of people say like, oh, I didn't realize, but I've actually been following you guys for years because we accidentally managed to nail a couple of SEO home runs back in the day. You know, back in the day when you could spend £5 on a Facebook ad, $5, and you could just reach like...
crush.
200,000 people, yeah. Yeah. So since then, that's kind of evolved over time. We've coached over 4,000 people through Propane, helping them to gain muscle and lose fat. And somewhere along that journey, we realized that a lot of the content that we were putting out was resonating more with other people like us, like other coaches, personal trainers. And so they started to be inquiring more to us and saying, hey, can you help me with some of the systems that you use to coach your clients with. And so we now have a separate arm to the business, which is also helping people do what we've done. And that's really just following the principle of like any specific expertise that you have, I think you should monetize it, because if it can help people, if it's something that you can package into a program or just into some content for them, then great. So we did that. Also, somewhere along the way, because of my kind of interest in physiology, it felt like very insatiable. I felt like there was a lot of bullshit in the industry and very hard to reconcile what's true and what's just kind of supplement marketing. And I wanted to get to the root of the mechanism. So I thought, what better way to do that than to go and get a medical degree? So
just a quick little detour there.
Little detour, yeah. So I thought I'd just bash out that little medical degree, and then so now I'm working as a doctor while doing the rest of this stuff too. Johnny used to be an accountant. He's gone full-time propane. I'm planning to join him quite soon, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah, so when did you decide to go back and become a doctor after you had already been successful with propane and already, or was this beforehand type thing?
Yeah, beforehand. So propane was
okay.
Very much just a bit of a laugh. Like, it was only turning over £1,000 or £2,000 a month.
Sure.
Or, so times that by 1.5 or so for dollars, isn't it?
Converted.
So yeah, that's so at the time it wasn't considered to be something that would ever really be profitable.
What age was this? I like giving people timelines.
Oh, so that was around 2012, 2013 is when I started medical training.
Okay.
I was working in an investment bank at the time. So I was about 23, 24.
Okay. Here's the thing, Yusuf. I also don't know if you're like 27 or 37. I really, like, I don't know how old you are. And I say that with love, but I just really don't know.
You know, I find that such an interesting idea. Like, I'm so fascinated by aging. And I think this is partly just because I'm currently working in a GPs, primary care.
General practice? Yeah.
Yeah. And you obviously see like the complete cross section of people, and you could see someone who's 50 and someone who's 25 years or 30 years older than them and is in much better shape and just generally better nick. And it's frightening how much that diverges because of lifestyle. And I think, so I'm 31, and I feel okay. Like 30 is the age where that divergence starts to materialize. And you see people who you went to school with maybe 15 years ago, and you're like, you haven't seen them since then. You're like, oh my God, what happened to you? Or like, yeah. So yeah.
I'm 27, so I'm getting there. So I get it. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm glad that I'm still looking young.
Yeah, all those, of course.
Thousands of cigarettes. I don't smoke, but yeah, I feel like.
Right. Okay. So you did the you got your degree, and then yeah. So as far as were you thinking, hey, I'm going to use this for something else, or was propane always kind of the big goal for you?
I don't think I thought too deeply about it. I was more led by a kind of ache in my soul to go and do medicine, and then just see how the cards play out. I didn't see propane as something that had much longevity in it. And really the thing driving me to medicine was just this urge to kind of fully understand things and also just apply the evidence basis into some kind of practice. You know, I think it's cool to be on the cutting edge of science, of, you know, physiology of metabolism and all this stuff. And I really respect the guys who do that. But I think it would drive me crazy not being able to translate that into some kind of clinical practice. So yeah, it was just a chapter in a book by a guy called David Dada. The book's called The Way of the Superior Man.
Oh, I've read it. I just the author didn't click with me, but then you said the title. I was like, oh yeah, I know that, yeah.
Oh yeah, fantastic book. Like,
yeah.
Bit of an audacious title, but
sure.
But yeah, one of the chapters you might remember is Live As Though Your Father Was Dead.
Mm, yeah.
And
yeah.
The idea in that is not so much about your physical father, but it's the symbol of living in the vicarious values and belief system of your culture and your religion and your ethnic background and all of that stuff, and being able to let go of that and just doing what it is that drives you. And so that combined with the idea that I could either take the plunge now or not, but that time's going to pass anyway, so
mm-hmm.
it needs to be done.
Yeah. And then I know you've worked into also, because I like the area of expertise, but I feel like you have, because now you've delved into another big one, I think, is productivity for you. And was this something that just happened through necessity from doing the doctor decree, basically, and then also doing other things?
Yeah, I used to be an absolute waste man. And I think it was just the realization when you do, so in the States, you do medicine as a postgrad course. So people already know the drill. They've already kind of, they've done some kind of science degree. They know how to be a graduate student. Whereas I think because, so my first degree was maths and business, which just didn't pressurize me enough to realize that actually all I was doing was just trundling along the bottom of the minimum effective dose to get by. And then doing medicine, as they describe it, as drinking from a fire hose. You're just being absolutely blasted with more information than you can take on reasonably, but also the conceptual difficulty of it and the symbols and the new vocabulary and everything. And you're just like, I don't know what's going on. So it just forces you to adapt. It's kind of like you turn up in your first day in the gym and that someone slaps on 600 pounds onto the bar and you just have to unrack it. And you're like, okay, I'm just going to have to do or die here. So doing that, I guess, was part of the fire that just meant, well, if I'm going to be trying to run a semblance of a business while doing this, then a lot of things have to change. So yeah, that's how it's developed, really.
Yeah. And I have to, so where did you first turn? I'm always curious how people like first delve into, because productivity obviously is a huge topic. How were you just like, okay, this works, this doesn't work? Were you doing a lot of testing? Were you doing a lot of just filtering other people you trust? How did that kind of work?
I like to work from principles first and then tactics and application later. And reading one of Cal Newport's early books, I think it was just called How to Be a Straight A Student, just really drove home the idea of the value of time and the opportunity cost of time.
I bought that book as well. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off, but not many people have heard of that book or read that book. And I was one who got that too.
Ah, brilliant. Yeah. I think we've probably got quite a shared library.
Yeah.
And so this was the point of having to time box things. You can't just YOLO your day. You can't just turn up and hope that things get done as they are. And also not all hours are equal. Not every task is created equal. So if you have a list of things on your to-do list and you know what your hourly rate is, you can estimate that, then anything that you're doing that is possible for someone else to do, like cleaning, meal prep, ironing, they should not be done by you. They are an active waste of your time, unless there is some other non-financial benefit into that. That it's, you know, if it's combined with family time, or if you get some kind of inherent enjoyment from cooking or something like that, brilliant. But I'm completely inept in the kitchen. I don't enjoy cooking. I'd prefer to just outsource that whole thing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, then, okay. So talk, I know it's not a long process, but it's an in-depth process, because I liked your productivity workflow. Will you speak to that real quick? Just the quick elevator pitch or the overview of it?
Yeah, sure. So the main principle is that what is more important than how. And so that's kind of what I'm saying there, that the value of your time is so great because you can leverage that. And you can arbitrage it as well. So you can do something that's worth more per hour and pay someone to do something that's less than that target that you've set. I know Naval talks about setting yourself a really high aspirational one of like $5,000 an hour and aiming for that. I think it's a cool way to operate, but it's not grounded in reality. You want to just kind of do it based on what you can today earn per hour if you were to really throw yourself in.
Right.
So once you've got that in place and you're knowing that anything that you're doing is actually taking you to your high level goal, that's half the battle. Because I think a lot of the time we are either not clear on our 3-year or 5-year vision, or we're just doing things and not realizing, oh, if I continued this harder, it's going to take me here, and that's not where I want to be. And that was the big mistake, really. You can do this on a macro level as well. Like, I was working in the investment bank and looking at my boss and thinking, if I work really hard, I'm going to be him in 10 years' time, and he's miserable. So
yeah.
What, you know, so that's one part of it. Then you also have just the setting up your environment. You can't always rely on discipline and willpower. So anything that you can do to disable Wi-Fi, set out a time box in your calendar. I've got two screens, and I use one of them with an app called TickTick to just have a big timer on that screen with the task below it.
Yeah.
So that it's the dickhead strategy. It's that you look over and you're like, I'm a dickhead.
It's so funny.
Oh.
I've got a kitchen timer right here. We're the same person. Fantastic. We figured it out. Yeah.
I think we are, man. This is this is spooky.
Match made in heaven.
So you need as many possible reminders to be like, if I go off task, I'm a dickhead. And I saw an article of a guy who hired somebody to sit next to him while he worked and slap him every time he went off target. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't, but that's aggressive, but it probably works.
So he said, like, throughout the whole shift, he didn't get slapped once because just the threat of it was enough.
Was it like a amazing, big, like, burly guy? I get like a professional slapper or something because it's really going to hurt.
That would be hardcore. I think he just got this like middleweight woman. So
what a great job, just chilling there, just watching him, just waiting to slap him.
I mean, yeah, if you're looking for some kind of service to offer online, maybe start posting on Craigslist and Gumtree and I'm a professional slapper. So there we are with focus. And I think being able to develop both the environment to make it as easy as possible to do the things you want to do, but also develop the capacity for concentration. And that's done from meditation and just from practicing, like, you know, sport specific work of doing the task and trying to stay on target. Single tasking is everything with technology and the environment now is set up against single tasking. We have browsers that enable multiple tabs, and our computers are getting more and more advanced to the point where you can switch between apps and have, you know, tile windows across the screen and everything. And that's not designed for high output. It's designed for being always accessible and always contactable and feeling like you're flitting between tasks. And it's not a recipe for calmness, and it's not a recipe for productivity.
So
I think even if you just got those big three things in place, you'd be doing really well. The rest of it really just relates to specific tools that I use to try and get that nailed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And digital tools.
Sure.
So that's really the high level overview.
That's perfect. But go ahead and plug your, because this is what I was wanting you to get to, is plug your resource.
Brilliant. Yeah. So if you go to YouTube/propanefitness, that is where we have a full 7-part series on that. Each video is only eight minutes or so, but it goes through the full workflow that I use to build Propane while managing normal relationships, not having to be sleep deprived, rental properties, and pass the medical degree and then work as a doctor, and being able to juggle it all without losing my sanity only losing a little bit of my sanity.
yeah. And the test there is to make sure that you watch the videos single tasking, making sure you're not doing other things as well, you know?
Yeah.
But there's two things that I want to touch on. The first one is just real quick. What I have found is that because I 100% agree with everything you're saying. But what I've also found is that I can be like a self-help junkie. And now what is happening, especially with technology and so much great content out there, is that I don't have silence often. And whenever I'm doing random things, like going to brush my teeth and like just do morning stuff, I want to turn on a podcast, right? Or even just any type of YouTube video, right? So what I'm wondering is, like, have you found yourself, even in these little moments where boredom is encouraged or just essentially no background noise is encouraged, do you find yourself doing the same thing, or are you just like, are you good to go? Are you a normal person?
No, I really resonate with what you're saying there. I mean, of course I do, because we're the same person, but someone tweeted a while ago, I don't remember who it was, like, if you think you're enlightened, try going to the toilet without your phone. Yeah. Like,
that's amazing.
It is crazy that, like, only, you know, you're 27. We're old enough to remember the days where you would go and have a poo and you'd be like reading the back of the shampoo bottle.
Whatever magazine was right there on the back. Yeah.
Yeah. It's frightening how quickly that has degraded into like, oh, let me just like cycle through every app and refresh the feed and check that I've not got any messages in the last 10 seconds. And
for like an hour, some people, I'm luckily I'm not this far to where I just like sit on the toilet for an hour, but I know some people that are literally like, my legs go numb and I don't care. I try to stand up and I like fall forward and I'm like, well, maybe it is a little bit too long.
Do you know what, man? Like, this is maybe a bit grim for your podcast, but
go for it.
The number of hemorrhoids that I'm seeing in clinical practice at the minute, like, pretty much everyone's got hemorrhoids now, and I do wonder whether part of that is because people are just sat pressurizing their anus on the toilet with their phone for hours rather than, you know, on and off.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
And then they're sitting for hours as well, right? So it's just like it's all. In the bum area, you know,
yeah,
all around
not
there.
Ideal.
That's funny. The second thing was, I feel like you are a very logical, rational, reasonable guy. I'm thinking of like left brain, right brain. And then I was surprised to hear that you also were so big, and it's not that these are mutually exclusive, but it's more so, I just think of like the rationality mind and then like spirituality and like meditation. And I heard that you did like a 10-day meditation retreat. So it's just, it was cool to see this blend of both, because I do think both are super important. So maybe when was the first like thing where you were like, okay, maybe I really need to start getting control of my mind and meditation, etc.
So I appreciate the compliment. I think this really comes from being like greed and FOMO. I just feel like we're so lucky to be placed into this body mind structure that has so much capacity and so many axes that you can explore, that it would be a shame to leave any of them unexplored. And so it's always just wanting to try and feel what it's like to be a complete person in every, you know, explore every dimension to its end point. And I've certainly got blind spots, and I'm certainly not great with like artistic kind of visual thinking, for example, but yeah, I think meditation is one of those avenues to explore. And that the same thing with training, like it's, and gymnastics and everything else. You just want to be able to play with what your body is capable of. And there are many people who might be disabled or have some reason why they can't do that. And it's almost being ungrateful to not explore that to its full capacity.
It's like doing a disservice.
Yeah, absolutely. So with meditation, it's one of the forms of spiritual practice. I actually don't think meditation is for everyone. And I also think if you're a knowledge worker, or if you're someone who spends a lot of your day from the neck up, meditation may be helpful, particularly if you have anxious tendencies and a very, you know, flitting mind, and mind is noisy. But it's one of the practices that you can use. I know so many people that were put off the whole purpose of spiritual practice because, oh, meditation doesn't work for me, or I tried meditation once and I didn't like it. Well, meditation is very much a neck up. It's a head or mind focused activity, but there's also heart focused ones, and there's body focused practices.
Like metta, loving so kindness. Think, is that what you're
yeah,
saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yoga and breath work and, you know, playing with temperature and all these different things. So I think it's about finding what is your personal bottleneck. And the analogy that I use is, if you're coaching someone and you have this guy who's like, you know, a classic fridge, like he's just a big dude. He's strong, but he's fat and he's slow. He's not very flexible, but he's just naturally like beefy and strong. You wouldn't be like, and you know, assuming he's coming to you and he wants to be an all round better athlete, you wouldn't be like, right, let's do some heavy bench press and then we'll switch onto some heavy deadlifts. And yeah, you'd be like, well, this guy needs to stretch and do some cardio and swim and, you know, explore his body. Equally, if you have like a proper 100-pound yogi that's super flexible but valgus knee and is really weak. And
for lack of better terms, ectomorph and endomorph, right? Kind of like that.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So you would use the protocol to bring them more to a complete person rather than just for them to lean into what they're already good at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, then walk me. I want to know. Like, I'm just curious because I have been increasingly more into meditation probably since I found the Waking Up app by Sam Harris.
Awesome.
I really enjoy it. And what I've always been curious about is these meditation retreats because I've thought about it, but also. Like a 10-day meditation retreat is no joke. So just real quick, I want you to, can you walk through that and then maybe some things that you learned from that or didn't learn from that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you're getting more into it. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah.
The 10-day retreat, so the general structure of it is one meal a day or two meals if it's the first time. It's 10 days, 4 a.m. to about 9 p.m. every day. Meditating.
Where are you? I want to know, like, I like the details. Where are you, like, in, like, with monks or, like, in this temple? What's the deal? So you're in a mountain?
There's different centers. Some of them would be monasteries and in with monks. Mine was a kind, it wasn't quite secular, but it was as close to that. It was in, like, a country house in countryside in the UK. If you ever get a chance, Matt, I would 100% recommend that center. It's called the IMC center in the UK.
Okay, cool.
It was beautiful. Food was amazing.
Excellent.
Everyone's so lovely. And it's in like a really idyllic kind of environment.
And what age did you do this at?
A couple of years ago.
Okay. All right, cool.
So you're doing it from, so someone comes around with a gong and wakes you up at, I'm trying to be as descriptive and tactile as possible.
Please.
they come and wake you up at 4 a.m. with this gong. You go into the meditation hall and you do 1 hour sit. Then they talk to you for 20 minutes or they deliver a kind of a brief talk with some talk about the Buddha or a lesson to reflect on for the day. And then you're back to doing basically 1 hour sits followed by 10-15 minute break and then back into it. So you're building up a lot of hours over that time. Then you have a short break to eat as well. Throughout the 10 days, the first 5 days is anapana, which is just focusing on the sensation of the breath passing the tips of the nostrils. So you're doing that for 5 days. So you're absolutely very in tune with that really specific spot on your nose for for that long. It's a bit weird. And then from day six, then you start doing the body scan, Vipassana style. So you're exploring all of the sensations in as fine detail and high resolution as possible from the head to the feet and just keep scanning. And you're doing that for the subsequent 5 days. On day six, when you actually switch method, it's like, oh my God, this is so exciting. So lovely to finally have like more sensations to
novelty.
Play with.
Yeah.
But it was difficult and painful and upsetting and grueling, and it's so funny because I spoke to Daniel Ingram, who is a guy, he's the author of Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha.
Yeah, I think I've heard of the name.
Oh, really fascinating guy. He's an emergency medicine physician that basically did 7 years of retreat time, like split out throughout his career. I might have got the number wrong, but he did a lot of retreat time. And he's completed meditation. He's basically now a self-described arhant, which is someone who has fully undone the illusion of self and now lives in a permanent state of no pointed self.
Got it. Right.
Dispersed consciousness. And he was, so when I was describing my experience to him, I was like, yeah, like day one, I was so sad. I felt like I was grieving. And then day two, I felt like anger, and then day three was lust, and you just like every sexual thought you've ever had just like running through your head, or it's so distracting. And day five was, and he was like, oh yeah, that's just the layers of the mind, like everyone goes through that in that order on retreat.
Interesting.
And I was like, oh my God, that's so, like, here I was thinking I'm some kind of unique special snowflake with these experiences.
Yeah.
And actually I was just experiencing the anatomy of the unfolding of the mind.
He's like, it's a calorie deficit, dude. You're fine.
Yeah, he's like, oh, damn it.
That's amazing. Well, okay, so why did you decide that this was the time to do a meditation retreat like that? Because that's not something most people do. Like it's a pretty big deal, I feel like.
Yeah, even the admin side of it, because 10 days, like, to get that in that much time, like, away from your emails and for things not to set on fire by the time you come home. It took a lot of, I've been really wanting to do it for so long, but just think all the little stupid excuses of, but I don't have too many emails, and what about this? And luckily, they were hosting one from the 20th of December to the 1st of January or something, like around that time. So it was over Christmas and New Year.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, brilliant, because usually not much is going on with business and stuff around that time.
Yeah,
and,
right.
I was a med student at the time as well, so it was after the exams. So yeah, it was perfect. And surprisingly, 80 people were on that retreat. So there was a lot of people who just sacked off Christmas and New Year and decided to spend it watching their nose.
Were you watching their nose? Do you guys? I promise I'll get into more interesting things. But for me, this is more like this whole podcast. I've said this multiple times. It's selfish. Like, I'm going to ask you questions that I want to know.
That's the best kind of podcast.
Okay, good, because that's what we're going to do. What I was wondering, do you guys talk to each other in there? Like, whenever you're obviously during practice, but like in between, are you able to talk and converse?
So I forgot to mention that there's no talking as well.
That's what I thought I heard, and I was like, that's even stranger, you know, for lack of a better, like, it's just strange. It's just interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the five precepts. So there's no killing, which is i.e. no eating meat, no talking.
Okay. I was like, that's good. You guys don't kill each other. That's a good rule.
Did you manage that, Yusuf? Not kill anyone for 10 days. so yeah, that, and then, the food restriction, there's no, you know what? I can't remember what the five precepts were.
Sure. No, that people can look it up. They can figure that out. But that's cool though, because I thought of that, and I was like, that would be. It's just sounds like such a profound experience, and I've heard Sam Harris talking about it a few times, and I think it's piqued my interest.
I think if you can make the time to do it, I would 100% recommend it. It's gentle. It's not like a psychedelic experience where it comes in and absolutely blasts you. Like, you are the one in control. You're in the driving seat, and you're gently and slowly unpicking your internal emotional stuff.
Right.
And the thing with the no talking and the no eye contact and stuff is that you're surrounded by people, but you're just kind of walking past them and not really engaging with anyone. And it's so strange, because you're sat in this hall, obviously, for 100 plus hours over the over the 10 days, and your brain just starts like giving people around you personalities. So you look at, you're like, oh, I bet that guy's a dick, or I like him, or oh, he looks French, he must be like this, and you just start like assuming and making stories about people in your head. Crazy.
Which is interesting, because that's kind of what you would do just walking down the street as well. Just like seeing random people, you're like, oh, I bet that guy hates his job or something. You know, it's just like something like that. You just assign these self-proclaimed personalities to these people. So what about the, because I know sometimes it's some people will do the three-day retreat first. Do you think that would even be worth it? Or do you think just jump straight into the 10-day retreat?
I don't think the centers in the UK actually allow you to do anything shorter than 10 days.
Okay. All right.
On the first round. I think once you've done a 10 day, then you can do a 2 or 3 days, like a top up.
Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, 3 days would, I think it would certainly be useful, but for me, the experience was like the first 2 or 3 days was just the mind quieting. You know, you feel like your mind is this jar of water with a bunch of like mud and cloudy sediment in it. And it just, over that time, when there's no input, it just starts to separate out, and then you've got the mud on the bottom.
Interesting.
And so the water separates. And then by day 6 and 7 and 8, that's when you're actually getting rid of the mud. You know, you're systematically kind of clearing it out.
Wow.
So I think probably 10 days you would have a different and deeper experience, and it's more of a healing process.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so what about now? Like, what's your meditation regimen now on a daily basis?
So at the end, they said they were like, yeah, well, your home practice, you can do So for us, they said do half an hour a day. In other centers, I've got a friend who they told him you should do 2 hours a day from now on. And they were like, well, it's easy enough because you'll sleep an hour less and you'll be an hour more productive. And it's like, ah, oh, damn it. Like, you've just ruined my excuses there as well.
Yeah.
But I've not been doing 2 hours a day. I've been maybe 10 to 30 minutes a day since then. I should be doing more. It's ridiculous that I don't. I think it's just life just catches you up. But
yeah,
you know, because you by the end of the 10 days, you're so sold on the method working, and it's like a no brainer to do it. But then, you know, once you're out of that environment, you things get caught up. So
throughout your day, do you ever have to have those like mental resets where maybe you do focus on your nose, right, to kind of prevent overwhelm and things?
Yeah, I think there is a big argument to say that meditation, when you're sat on a cushion, like anyone can be peaceful sat on a cushion, but the real challenge is being able to translate that into daily life. And that's why Vipassana as a method is, you know, that was Daniel Ingram's method, because he was working in a busy hospital and he was able to kind of extend his practice to almost 24 hours a day, because all you're doing is paying attention to sensation in a high resolution. And so he was like, because I asked him, like, well, how do you do that when your hospital's a very like cognitively demanding job? And so surely you haven't got the mental bandwidth to be focusing on sensation when you're trying to think of which antibiotic to prescribe this patient and assessing the heart murmur. And he was like, well, there's so much, he's like, such a high percentage of the day is actually not doing that stuff. It's like walking down the corridor and listening to the sound of your feet echoing in the
staircase,
the hallway.
Yeah. Or in the hallway.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Or like, I don't know, the sensation of holding the papers in your hand. And so for him, he sees the world in a very sensory way and realizing that actually this thought stuff is only really a small percentage of our daily experience, but we blow it up to be this all encompassing stressful thing. And that's why we get so stressed, because like we've blown up all of our problems and stories, which don't really exist objectively, and we've made it into the entire of our awareness.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a break glass in case of emergency strategy, in case like you are feeling just completely frazzled, reactive, whatever? Is there something that you go to, whether like a longer duration thing or just in the moment type thing?
Yeah, so for me, I can't do a break glass just from cognitive and mental inputs. I have to deal with it from the body.
Oh.
So for me, it's always slowing my breath and quite often just tuning into your body, and you realize that, oh, I'm like sat at this desk, like hunched over, my shoulders are eating my ears and I'm breathing shallow, and why am I sat like this? And then suddenly just realizing, oh, actually, like all this muscle tone is completely unnecessary. And then the breathing can drop deeper into the abdomen. And so I think addressing that, often the mind follows suit. It's very hard to be anxious in a relaxed body.
Yeah. Or whenever you're focused on just like these things going through the proprioception, just of each, starting with the head and going all the way down, feeling these different things. I actually was talking to Dr. Amelia Thompson. Do you know of her?
I think we follow her on Instagram.
Yeah. 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 So we talked about these types of things as well. And she has her PhD. You guys are both, you know, smarter than this guy. But so one of the things that I was telling her was that something that I do whenever I do get stressed like that, to kind of get out of my mind and into my body, is I'll literally, and this could be if I'm in a, I could even be like sitting at a table or something, talking with people or whatever it is, I start to scratch my leg. Not like a vicious scratching, but it's literally just feeling like a crackhead or something. But no, it's literally just like I start to feel my nail against my leg. And what it does is it just kind of, it grounds me back into reality, if that makes sense, you know?
That's really cool. Well, because then you're like, oh my God, like the sense of Matt extends all the way down there. And it's not just this little point up in my, behind my eyes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's great.
That's and so that was interesting. And what you just said was also interesting that I heard on Waking Up, and it blew my fucking mind. And I put it on my story and people thought it was interesting as well. It was just like you said, the point, you're not just a point behind your head. It's just like, are you like, if you think about the back of your head right now, and then you think about the front of your face, like, where are you in between those two points, right? And it's such a mind fuck whenever Sam told me that. And I was just like, he was like, think about like moving your foot, right? Or moving your hand, right? And so you can feel those things. You can feel yourself doing those things. But then think about what you normally think of, like, where you are in space. And most people would say, oh, I'm behind my face and like behind or in front of the back of my head.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it's crazy.
I'm so glad that Sam Harris has brought self-inquiry to the mainstream, because yeah. I think it's a really powerful practice. Gary Weber is a guy who
I've heard of the name.
Yeah, he's worth checking out as well. He doesn't do podcast appearances anymore, unfortunately. But his book is amazing. It's called Happiness Beyond Thought.
Okay, and is it Weber?
Yeah, correct. Okay, so right. He was working in some kind of corporate, and he was a VP, like quite a, you know, high powered job, but he was doing 4 hours of spiritual practice every day, like from 4 a.m. before his family woke up. And one day his thoughts just stopped, and that was it. So he said there was no ceremony, nothing crazy. It just, his thoughts stopped in the middle of a downward dog yoga pose. And he turned up to work and there was just nothing going on in his head. And he said people were asking him questions in the meeting, and the body just continued its momentum. It was answering in the really eloquent ways, like better than he could come up with himself.
Interesting.
And he's just like, oh, well, this is this is so strange. So he's someone who very much built in a lot of the self-inquiry that you're talking about here into his practice. And that all comes from Ramana Maharshi, or one of the big kind of origins of this. Who believed that the self was actually in the heart, or like in the, you know, in the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And so we often perceive it to be, yeah, as you said, like in that kind of point. But he says, if you trace it back hard enough, you feel the origin kind of there.
Yeah.
I think I've heard, you realize that it doesn't exist at all.
I think I've heard Locke Kelly talk, you know, Locke Kelly. I think he talks about some of this as well. And I think it is, or maybe something similar. I think it might be the loving kindness type of meditation where you wish well upon other people and et cetera. And I think that's just, it's so interesting to go through those.
Yeah, massively.
Yeah. Have you, okay, so now, and then referring back to your kind of analytical brain and then also the spiritual brain, do they ever, at least maybe not now, because maybe you've looked into it more and you've learned more, but in the beginning, were you just like, am I completely full of shit? Is this spirit? Because most of the people that I hear with spirituality, I think of just not complete nonsense, but people take it way too far. And then I think of like horoscopes and all these different things. And it's just like, do those ever clash? And how do you kind of get through that, I guess?
Yeah. My principle again is using some kind of empirical method to verify things. So it may not be that there's any scientific data. There might not be that there's a peer-reviewed journal about something, because it could be a phenomenon which can't be measured according to some objective metric. But if you can empirically prove it in your experience, for example, then you can start to pull on that golden thread and see whether it rings true in the majority of cases. And so you can be a little bit, you can apply the scientific method within yourself, and you don't then have to make these big leaps of faith. I used to be religious. I was brought up as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime about 7 or 8 years ago, that started to kind of collapse in on itself, just because I think doing more and more spiritual practice, I'm not saying that I'm some advanced spiritual athlete or monk or anything like sure. that, but it was just kind of dipping my toe into it, that it was like, ah, actually, like all of the stuff with religion is really symbols and icons and labels, and it doesn't reach the core thing. Now, I'm not anti religion. I'm very grateful for the fact that I had that upbringing, and I think there's a lot of beauty and truth in Islam. But the what we know nowadays to be Islam is kind of just a set of labels, and it's like kind of old rope that unless you touch its core, then you're not really getting at it, and it has to be an experiential process. I don't know if I'm making much sense there.
Yeah, but I think so. Well, you know what's interesting is I got a whole different view on religion after I found, and I don't know how you feel about him, but Dr. Jordan Peterson's work. I listened to his lectures on the clinical the psychology behind his biblical series, essentially, and where he went through the verses and things, and you know, a lot of the things that he was saying, I was just like, it just put religion in a whole different perspective, and how he said it came to be, and how these lessons have stood the test of time. Just that in and of itself shows that there's something there that speaks to humans everywhere.
Yeah, it's an exceptional series, and it's
game changing.
Brings it out from a social origin, and almost the basic structure of our minds are set to kind of seek meaning in stories, and that's how it manifests, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And then so another thing that I wanted to touch on was something that I've been more just thinking about a lot more is kind of the idea of balancing acceptance with striving, right? So it's just like, how can we, and I think this is where kind of the meditative spiritual practice, grounding yourself in things can come in handy. But then also I have my other, you know, late 20-year-old mind and wanting, you know, I want to do so many things, and I want to build this name for myself, and I want to make money and do all these different things. And they're constantly kind of fighting with each other. So maybe how do you kind of balance that accepting how things are now, and then also striving for improvement?
I have a bit of a controversial view that an intense desire for something doesn't confer more efficiency in achieving that thing. I would say it probably does the opposite in a lot of cases. And it's the same as if you're just gripping too hard on something, then you end up almost causing yourself more suffering when doing it, but also probably achieving the opposite.
Yeah.
And the best way that is exemplified, and this is more with kind of, you know, this is if you are operating in a complex system. So if you're trying to do sales or picking up women or anything that involves like interacting with another person, if you've ever had like a door-to-door salesman who comes to your house and he's super keen and he's really trying to like push for the sale, and he's like, oh hey, how are you, and he's like super agreeable, and he's like, oh yeah, you would be like, well, I don't trust this guy, because like they're trying too hard for a certain outcome.
You're like, what are you hiding? So I see it's like the overly nice person. Sorry to cut you off, but that's just immediately what my mind went to. When you see an overly friendly person, you're like, you're compensating for something else.
Absolutely. And the overly nice person is actually the dark side of that. And it's the same, it's the same coin, opposite side. Is that overly nice person is also overly controlling, because they are trying to manipulate people around them by being so nice and being so agreeable that they have tried to twist the world around them to do that. And so that's why we trust people who might have a goal, but they're open about it, and they are kind of not bothered either way. It's a weird, as you say, it's a weird paradox. It's a hard thing to kind of reconcile the two, where if you have a salesman who's like, hey, I'm going to see 1,000 houses today, and I've got 10 windows to sell. Someone's going to buy them. I thought I'd offer it to you first, but if not, I'm not bothered. In fact, if you don't buy them, I'm going to have them myself, because they're really great windows.
No, I get what you're saying, though. Yeah, absolutely. And that's interesting, because I'm reading a book right now. It's called Dancing with Life, and it's excellent. And one of the chapters is on desire and like clinging, essentially, right? And one of the things that he said to me, it was one of those things where you haven't been able to articulate something, but then you read it and you're like, oh shit, yes, that's exactly right. And he was saying that you can still uphold your values and have these desires and things and care about making progress in your life, but you can give up the clinging to the attachment to the outcome, right? And I butchered that, but essentially he's like, you can still care about something without caring as much about clinging to a certain outcome happening, right? And I just, that really stuck with me because it's just like, you can still work really hard towards something, but then the outcome, whenever you know, like you said, sometimes trying too hard or caring too much actually is counterproductive, right?
Everyone's got an experience of that happening where you give up on something and then it happens. Like as soon as you like emotionally resign yourself to being like, oh, whatever, and then it happens. And I think this is the power of prayer. This is why prayer works as a device, because what you've done is you've written the letter to God, you've posted the letter, and then you're like, oh, okay, it's out of my hands now. And it's a device to emotionally release from a certain desire.
It's like a surrender.
And then it happens. Yeah, surrendering, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, man. That is super, that's interesting. Yeah, these topics are they're still so a lot of it is new to me and I'm still very much like in it trying to figure it out, but it's been fun to try to kind of explore your own mind, but it's also just such a web and tangled of things that, because it's just like you said, it's those layers and you have to slowly unpeel that onion. But like you mentioned, the Waking Up app has been not even just the meditation itself, which the introductory course is great, but the lessons and the theories within it have helped me tremendously, you know.
That's so cool. And I think it's so difficult with some of the progress with this stuff, because I think with training and with any mental effort, it's kind of linear and you can see the progress, and whereas sometimes a lot of the spiritual work can kind of blindside you, or you're working on a certain thing and yet something's trying to tell you something else and you're not open to the lesson, and then when you do open to it, you're like, oh well, I wasn't looking for that, and something's now changed, or some background processing happens, and it's only, you don't always draw the cause effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a funny one.
I think doing meditation and having these practices opens the door to more serendipity to happen within your, like these breakthroughs or whatever you want to call them. I think they're more likely to happen because you're more open in general and aware of these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? See what I'm saying? Yusuf, we could chat for a very long time, I'm sure, but I do want to be respectful of your time. We'll definitely have to do this again. But first, where can people find out more about you and Propane?
So I would just look for Propane Fitness, that is as in Propane the gas, one word, on any social media platform. So
yeah.
YouTube and Twitter are our main ones at the moment. If you're interested in some of the articles, the longer form written stuff that we have, then propanefitness.com is a great place to start as well.
Yeah, and it's absolutely excellent. I'll put those links in the description for you guys to check out. And like I said, real quick, I want to talk to you for like 2 minutes off air. But Yusuf, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Very keen for part two.
Good, good. We'll do it again. Thanks, man. And that is that, my friends. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the More Than Fitness podcast. And please, if you could help me out a little bit here and leave a rate and review in iTunes, and also take a screenshot and post it up on your IG story. Tag me at MattMcLeod6. I'd love to share it. I'd love to connect with you. I'd love to hear your feedback about the podcast, and also so that we can share the word with other people. I would love to build up this community, build up this tribe of people that we have like you and I, and get the word out there. Also, if you want more free content, you can check the links in the description. I have my free 4-week workout plan, The Ultimate Physique Development. And also, if you want to work with me online, one-on-one for personal coaching, you can check the link in the description as well. And anything else you need, please send me an email, send me a DM. I would love to hear from you. Again, thank you so much for listening.